Hello, and welcome back to the Chem Talk podcast. On today's episode, we interview Dr. Irene Chen, who has earned both a BA in chemistry and an MD PhD in biophysics from Harvard. She currently runs the Chen Lab at UCLA, where she and her team study bacteriophages, viruses that infect bacteria. Dr. Chen's research focuses on the role of phages in bacterial infections, diagnostics, and therapeutics. Hi, Dr. Chen. Thank you so much for speaking with us today on the Chem Talk podcast. My name is Roxanne. I am a second year in human health and disease at Trinity College in Dublin, and I'm here today with my colleague, Clarice.
Hi, my name is Clarice. I'm an incoming high school senior.
Great. It's nice to meet you both.
Today, we'd like to talk a little bit about your research, what got you interested in the field of chemistry. So do you mind just sharing a little bit about your science background?
Yeah, I guess that I'm one of those people who's always been interested in science. I didn't know what type of science really when I was growing up, but I kind of knew I wanted to be a scientist. And then when I got to college, I realized that chemistry was kind of a central science. It's been called a central science, I think, traditionally. There's a mixing of physics and biology. You can really go in so many different directions for applications. So I found that really fascinating, and I majored in chemistry in college. Then I was kind of unclear about what direction from there I wanted to take. So I had some interest in biology. I didn't know how medical my research should be. So I did a combined MD-PhD program. And after that program, going to grad school, working in a lab, I realized that that was what I really wanted to do with my life, to just continue grad school indefinitely. After I graduated, I did a postdoctoral fellowship and then became a professor. And now I run a research lab.
Great. And you're with UCLA, right?
Yes.
Okay. And part of what you focus on is bacteriophages. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And so I'm really interested in that. Can you give us a little bit of just background? So bacteriophages are viruses that infect bacteria, right? So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, exactly. Phages, short for bacteriophages, are literally bacteria eaters. And they've been around probably as long as bacteria have been around, billions of years. They were discovered a little bit more than 100 years ago, when people realized that if you grew a culture of bacteria, then sometimes it would clear, or you'd see if you were growing like a plate of bacteria, you might see a clear, region. And they figured out that those clearings, that the death of those bacteria there, were caused by a virus. And these viruses are pretty much totally unrelated from the viruses that infect people. They are really specialized on bacteria. So people thought about, as soon as it was discovered, as soon as phages were discovered, people thought about using them as an antibacterial agent. And probably anybody who like learns about phages for the first time thinks, hey, can we use these to kill bacteria and treat bacterial infections? But that line of thinking, it kind of died down a little bit after the discovery of antibiotics and penicillin. And those were really, miraculous drugs that have controlled infectious disease for quite some time now. But now that we're starting to see the increasing incidence of antibiotic-resistant infections, we probably hear about it on a regular basis in the newspaper, superbugs that have multiple drug resistances, and these genes for drug resistance get transmitted among bacteria pretty easily, and they're highly selected for because of the use of antibiotics. Because of that problem, people have started to look toward developing new technologies for fighting bacterial infections. And they've one of the directions people are exploring, including my group, is to return to phages and ask if we can use them as a basis for a new antimicrobial therapy.
What are the challenges when it comes to using those as a therapy?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think you could put together kind of a list of challenges. I think some of the major ones are with using a natural phage. So phage therapy, as it's kind of like maybe traditionally envisioned, would involve giving a more or less naturally occurring phage that is lytic. So it lyses bacteria, it kills them, and relying on the kind of natural progress of the viral infection of the bacteria to eliminate the bacterial host of the phage. Mm-hmm. And that might work, and it seems like it has worked in some kind of isolated or anecdotal cases. But with that, there are a few challenges. And one of the major ones is that phages tend to be pretty specific. So they might not infect, let's say you had a phage that infected E. coli, which causes gastrointestinal infections. That phage may only infect, you know, one out of hundreds of strains of E. coli because they're highly specific for the receptors that are expressed on the cell wall of the bacteria. So I would say that specificity can be a problem. There are kind of maybe a couple of ways to try to approach that problem. One would be to make a phage that is able to recognize many different strains, like a broad range phage. And then the other would be to have like kind of a bank of many phages, thousands of phages, and to screen that bank whenever you want to target a particular strain. So I think that's a solvable problem with enough work. Using either or both of those types of strategies. And, you know, making a broad host range phage as well as some highly specific ones, having both of those on hand would, I think, be terrific. Much like, you know, infectious disease experts now, they can prescribe a broad spectrum agent if they don't know what the causative organism is, and then they can move to a more specialized antibiotic if they figure out what it is kind of later in the course of the treatment. So having that flexibility, I think, would be great. So I would say that specificity is a main issue. And then the next issue is if you're taking a naturally occurring phage, phages are also known to have some effects that would be detrimental to a human. So there are some types of phages where if they infect the bacteria, this has been shown for Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is mostly a lung pathogen, a lung and wound pathogen. If these particular phages infect the bacteria that are causing the bacterial infection, they'll actually make the infection worse. So the physical structure of the phage makes this a very thick biofilm when it's together with the bacteria. And that actually makes that bacterial infection more difficult to clear. So we want to avoid those kinds of maybe unpredictable problems with kind of giving somebody a naturally occurring phage. There might be some consequences that would be difficult to predict. There also is the potential for phages to transfer genes among bacteria. They're one of the main ways that bacteria acquire new genes. So we kind of want to keep a lid on that at the same time. So we want to make sure that whatever phages we do use have been studied carefully and engineered to kind of control these different possible safety issues. So I guess I'd see those as the two like major problems right now. But again, I think with the right design and the right engineering, these problems can be overcome.
Yeah. So when you talk about natural phages, is that as opposed to something you could potentially engineer in a lab to fight something specific?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So naturally occurring phage might, you know, just be something you pull out of the environment. Whereas an engineered version of that, you might change its specificity. You might try to, you know, expand the host range. You might try to engineer some of these safety controls, like perhaps you might want to limit the amount of replication that the phage could undergo on its own. You might want to attach other molecules, perhaps even antibiotics or other kind of antimicrobial structures to the phage. So I think there's a lot of room for creating, designing something that could be better and safer than an actual phage.
Could you give an example of like how you might make something more or less specific? Like what steps do you go through in the lab for that?
Yeah, so there are multiple mechanisms that are required for a phage to be able to start an elytic infection. So the first step would be simply binding and attachment of the phage particle to the host cell. And that's where actually a lot of specificity is. So just that binding event, that initial recognition, having that tight interaction is one place where there's specificity. So you could imagine if you knew what proteins were involved in that interaction, you could engineer the phage to bind to a desired receptor. Perhaps you could pick a receptor that's more common among different strains, or a receptor that happens to be common among virulent strains. Once you have kind of passed that, then you've got your phage attached. If you want to create an infection, so now if I feel like you have kind of a branching point, you could attach something to your phage that would sort of mechanically kill the bacteria. So we have done that with gold nanoparticles, which you can heat up and use that heat to basically cook the bacteria. If you want to go on the genetic implementation side, then you want to try to get genes into the bacteria that would kill it. And that might be the genes of phage replication, or it might be a CRISPR-Cas system, which some people have engineered into phages as well. So there could be some different genetic programs that you could use the phage to start in the bacteria. But if you go that road, you do need to get the DNA across the cell wall of the bacteria and replicated. So then you have a few more steps to consider and to make sure that it's compatible with the bacteria that you're targeting.
When it comes to the using the nanoparticles of gold, you were saying, how would that transfer like into patient care? How would you deliver that?
Yeah. So in the technology that we've been developing, we conjugate the gold nanoparticles to the phages. So there's a covalent bond. Make these structures covalently, so they're pretty stable. So the phages are basically acting as carriers for these gold nanoparticles. Gold nanoparticles might be familiar to some people as one of the ways that glasses are colored. Colloidal gold, these like tiny particles of gold can be used as like a coloring agent. They have a very strong absorption at certain wavelengths in the near visible and visible range. So we can take advantage of that because this absorption of light can be translated into heat through a phenomenon called surface plasmon resonance. This is basically like the electrons of the nanoparticle resonating upon absorption of light. So you do an electronic absorption of light. The energy of that light gets transferred into heat, and then that heat can be pretty intense and intense enough to kill surrounding cells, specifically the bacteria that the phages are bound to. That's something that's actually a little bit more general in medicine, in kind of nanomedicine. People have been looking at these gold nanoparticles for killing cancer cells, and there might be some other, you know, applications for this general idea. Here we're trying to merge that together with the phages.
Okay. And one more question on that before I hand it over to Clarice. When you are treating someone, how big of a quantity are you going to have to give? How do bacteriophages react to bacteria? Is it like one? Can they kill one? Can they kill multiple?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when we look at electron microscopy, so we try to take a look at how many phages are associated with the bacteria, it It for the phages that we're using, it could be one to maybe a few. So it's not a ton of phages on the it's not a ton of phages per bacterial cell. But each phage carries maybe like 20 gold nanoparticles. So that kind of amplifies the effect. But yeah, those are important details that we need to try to figure out, like what's the minimum effective dose and things like that we need to figure out.
Ultimately, what is the goal of your research, and what do you see it going in the next maybe 10 years, 20 years?
Oh, that's a great question. So there's a lot of struggle in the community of scientists who are working on antibacterial agents, in the sense that we know that this is an impending crisis. You know, we can see it kind of, you know, in our future. But at the same time, companies, you know, pharmaceutical industry, they don't have that much incentive to develop new antimicrobial agents, because I think the economics of it just don't work out very well for them. You know, and if you think about an antibiotic, it's a drug that you take for 1 or 2 weeks. It works incredibly well. You probably don't have to take it again in your life. You know, it's not a chronic medication the way that a cancer treatment or a heart disease treatment or something like that would be. So because of that kind of like limited economic incentive, I think what we have to do as a research community is develop these technologies to the point where they could be commercialized. And even if nobody picks it up right now, we need to have these like in the freezer, in the literature. And then when we do have a crisis, kind of like with, you know, COVID-19, people have been developing mRNA vaccines for other purposes, for other infectious diseases, then a crisis came and they could quickly pivot to COVID-19. My hope is that we'll develop these technologies again to that point. And then once we see, industry or other bodies see that need to develop the technology further, then they'll have everything they need to take it to the next step. So, you know, my goal is, I would, of course, love to see this technology and other phage technologies and other antimicrobial technologies, you know, come to play in my lifetime. But I think my realistic goal is to take it to the point where it could be adopted quickly once we need it. And as we know, infectious diseases can move very quickly. So we want to make sure we're as close as possible to that point.
What steps are you specifically taking to make this technology like accessible whenever we may need it, or like commercial whenever we may need it?
So the first thing that all of us do in the scientific community, at least in academic science, is publish our work. So we publish the results, the methods. I'm working to develop a book of phage engineering methods, which will be even more detailed protocols than what you might see in a paper. So just writing that down, getting it into a format that anybody can access. I think that will have those protocols at least on paper for people to access when they need to. And there's some really exciting, I guess they're not that new anymore, but there's some really nice venues for protocols now where people can just take videos of themselves doing the procedure, because there's always like little things that don't quite make it. They don't, you know, people don't always think of writing it down, you know, in the way that they handle their technique. So I think like videos would be a great way to transmit information in addition to just like training students. So the next generation of students from my lab will hopefully know how to do this, and they'll be around when they're needed. So that kind of like a combination of human resource and kind of literature resource, I think that's probably the best we can do in terms of archiving that knowledge.
Can you talk a little bit more about what it takes for this kind of technology to become commercialized?
So I guess one of the things that you need to do is protect the intellectual property. So it needs to be something that can be patented. I think with engineering, with a new method development, that's not too much of a barrier. You're making something new. Maybe you've got some tricks to your method that could be patented. So I guess there needs to be that protection first off. And the reason for that is that then industry could be potentially interested in it because they'll have the exclusive ability to profit from it. So there's that angle. I don't think that's I don't know, that becomes like sort of a complicated discussion, but because we're also talking about, well, you want to, publish everything so that people, so that the knowledge gets transmitted. I am sure that in the course of developing the technology further, there's always little things that can be, or not so little things that can be patented. So I guess that's maybe like the basis of it, but then you also need to convince industry that there's a viable business model, I guess. Like, who can you sell this to? How much money could you sell it for? How much is it going to take to develop this? Any new drug is a huge endeavor for a company with the clinical trials. So there's that kind of like there has to be sufficient reward, I guess, at the end of that for an industry to want to be able to pick it up and develop it.
Yeah. So going back to your research, what do you think is the most interesting or surprising or maybe even challenging part that you've overcome so far?
That's interesting. I feel like the big challenges are actually still in front of us. The thing that the problem I really want to solve is this question of host specificity. I feel like it's solvable because it will just require some engineering of the binding interaction if we combine it with our gold nanoparticles. I feel like it's solvable, but we do have to show that it can be done. That's the I think big barrier in my opinion for where we are right now from the kind of molecular engineering perspective, and then from a more application perspective. Right now, phages and phage-based technologies like ours, they can probably be like applied pretty well on like the surface of a wound or something that's kind of like accessible to kind of nano-size particles. But when you talk about like somebody who's got, I don't know, maybe a septic infection, bacteremia in the bloodstream, trying to get the phage around to the entire body, that's something that antibiotics are really good at. They're small molecules. They can you can inject them or take them orally, and they can get distributed throughout most of the body. Phages, because they're kind of larger particles, don't have the same availability throughout the body. So I think another challenge will be figuring out how to deliver these agents to the place that they're needed. And it might be that phages are, best suited to certain applications and not to other applications. And I think figuring that side of things out will be a major challenge going forward too.
So earlier you talked about two ways of approaching this issue of specificity. So are you working on both right now or just one at a time?
We are actually working on both. I like to take the when we have a challenge in front of us, I think I like to take the approach of just try everything, and some things might work out, some things might not work out. But if you, it's faster to try to do it all at the same time than if you have the resources than to try to test things one at a time. So I. And sometimes you learn things in one, direction that might help you with another direction. So whenever possible, we'll try to take that kind of parallel approach to challenges and troubleshooting. I guess it's kind of a general philosophy.
So, I guess in the lab, what does your testing kind of process look like? Are you using like computer models or like testing with real substances, or how does that look like?
Yeah, we're primarily an experimental lab. We are, working with real phages and testing them on real bacterial strains. There's, I think, a growing importance of computational science in basically every field. So we do have some computational work with analyzing phages from the natural environment or from the wound environment, actually, and also in the design of our designing our receptor binding proteins, so the proteins that we want to use to make the phage bind to the right bacteria. So there is some, there are some computational elements, but I would say that like the testing, we're basically doing that experimentally.
Right. And what does a day in your life look like, I guess, from both the professor side and also research side?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that has changed. When I was a student and a postdoc, I definitely spent most of my time in the lab, you know, doing experiments, thinking about a project very deeply. Now, as a professor, I have graduate students and I work with postdocs, and we all talk together at least once a week in our group meetings. And then on a kind of day-to-day basis, I might meet with a couple students or postdocs to talk about how their projects are going. You know, they take the lead on any particular project and strategy, and they become the expert on that. And I'm there to support them, to try to advise them. It helps, I think, to have at least a couple of people thinking about the same thing, because you know, it's easy to miss things, and having, you know, I guess two minds is better than one. And we have different perspectives on things too. Often a student will come in with a particular interest, and I'll say, oh, I've never thought about how we could apply phages in that particular situation or that application. And so that'll spark something new in my lab. So yeah, it's most of my day, I guess, during the summertime is working with students and postdocs, thinking about how to develop new projects, get funding for new projects, publish the results that we've that we found in the lab. During the school year, I also have classes to teach. So I teach undergraduates in the chemical and biomolecular engineering department.
So how did you know you wanted to become a professor? Did you have like a specific mentor that really inspired you in that way?
I definitely really admired several of the research advisors I had, I guess, growing up kind of scientifically. So that started with Carol McLeod at UC San Diego. So when I was a high school student, I had the opportunity to work with her in her lab. And that was just such a fun experience. I loved the environment of the lab. And Carol was really inspiring. And all the people in the lab were so fun to interact with. And then when I became an undergraduate, I joined a lab at Harvard. That was the lab of Greg Verdine in chemical biology. And he is just phenomenal, and he has a lot of knowledge about translating the work from his lab into technologies and companies, and seeing that additional layer of how chemistry could impact people through the kind of the road of commercialization, that was really eye-opening too. Like seeing the process of taking these basic science investigations like all the way to an application. That was really cool. And then in grad school, the person that has probably advised me the most is my grad school advisor, Jack Szostak. He is just an amazing scientist, Nobel laureate. And the way that he approaches problems by kind of dissecting them and almost like very systematic, like making a list of problems. And I found myself doing that with this phage project also, like making a list of problems we need to overcome and just kind of doing them one by one. Thing, you know, very general kind of approaches and also specific advice. That's just been really incredibly helpful. So yeah, I guess I would say that you know, seeing those people was really inspiring for wanting to do academic science. I did, there's a lot of great science happening in the industry too. I did kind of consider after my postdoc whether I wanted to go in that direction. Ultimately, I felt that academia was kind of the best fit for me. And as you can see, something like antimicrobial research is probably something that's that more academics are focused on than industry is, at least at this stage of the crisis, I guess. It's I think the right place for me, and I love working with students too.
Yeah, I think mentors are really important, I guess, in the growth of a student. I guess, what is your favorite part about being a professor, and also your worst part, maybe, if there is any?
So my favorite part is watching people grow. So I don't know, that's something I think, you know, if you asked me 10 or 20 years ago, I think I would have said, oh, you know, like the science is so exciting. And I still feel that it is really exciting. But like, as a professor specifically, I think the thing that I've really I'm really starting to appreciate is like watching students come in at a certain point in their life and watching them develop their interests and, you know, 5, 10, 15 years later, seeing where their career has taken them and what they've gotten to do and where they're going. I just think that's incredibly, watching their journeys has been really fulfilling on top of just the fun of the science itself. The worst thing I would say is the difficulty in finding funding. Probably every academic will say the same thing, I'm guessing, I don't know. You know, it's there's a lot, I think there's a lot of time, and I'm not gonna say it's wasted, because certainly this is it's important to craft a research proposal in order to have like a clear idea of what you wanna do. But you know, sometimes the competition is just so intense, you know, if only 1 in 10 proposals gets funded, which is, you know, not atypical, then, you know, so many good proposals are not getting funded. And that's, you know, painful, I think, both from the side of being a reviewer, and also from the side of being an applicant. So I don't really know how to fix that problem. But I guess I would say that that's probably the frustrating part of being in academic science. It's like making sure that flow of funding is secure and continuous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think is the most valuable, I guess, experience for a student who wants to be in STEM in the future to have?
Oh, do you mean an undergraduate level or high school? Or,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so if you want to do research in the future, and certainly if you want to go to grad school, getting some exposure in a lab, I think, is really important. Science in a textbook and science in a laboratory, they're so different, you know. It's kind of like the difference between reading about history and like living through the history, you know, it's completely different. So for people who want to go into science, I would say some like real hands-on experience, or dry lab or wet lab, you know, for whatever your interest is, some real experience on that kind of cutting edge is important.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Roxanne, do you have any more questions?
Yeah, I do. So going back to when you were getting your PhD, were you starting to think about studying phages then, or was that what your supervisor's lab was on?
Oh, so actually my supervisor's lab, the Shostak lab, was working on origin of life and developing primitive cells, like what are the minimum pieces that you could put together, minimum biological, biochemical pieces you could put together to make kind of a self-replicating cell. And so I worked on membranes and self-reproducing membranes. And something we didn't talk about at all is part of my lab is still working on protocells and understanding the evolution of protocells. The thought of working on phages actually goes back to when I was an undergrad and I took a class on molecular biology, and I learned about phages for the first time. I'd never heard of them before that. And I think I was one of those people who was just like, why don't we use these as antibacterial agents? And that kind of just stuck in my mind for a long time. And then I had kids, as a postdoc, and I started to think, okay, what can I do to actually improve their life, in a concrete way? And thinking about how instrumental antibiotics are. I don't know if you guys have ever taken antibiotics, but if you've ever had pneumonia or some other infection, it feels absolutely horrible. And then you take a drug for 2 weeks and it's gone. It really is kind of a miracle. And I feel like we really have to make sure that we keep that, keep a hold on that ability and not slip backwards in our ability to control bacterial infections.
Yeah. And in regards to antibiotics, and as kind of talking about when or reserving this research for when funding is available, what do you think has to happen for funding to go into this research?
Yeah, I guess that'll have to be a more obvious crisis.
Yeah.
It's almost like it has to get worse just to get the attention of governments and other places that might invest in this. Certainly the NIH and NIAID, there are people who are looking out for this, and the CDC. People are aware that this is coming up, but to get the real kind of mobilization of resources, I hope we don't have anything like a pandemic, but maybe something a little bit more slow moving. If we start to see it become more obvious, more people get affected, then I guess that could be when the incentives will pile up. And even if industry doesn't step in, at least maybe the government or other nonprofits will step in. That's my hope.
Yeah. And in terms of like something specific that would happen, because, sometimes from, bad food, and then people get really sick. So like, would it be something like that where just a ton of people would eat something that's had bacteria on it? And is that kind of what you're thinking?
Maybe something like that. Yeah. Like a mini epidemic somewhere, I guess. That would certainly get a lot of attention for sure. And could push people forward. I think we've seen kind of hints of individual organisms becoming problematic. The CDC has this threat list of organisms that they're keeping an eye on. I think Candida auris kind of made the headlines maybe like last summer or something for ear infections that were untreatable. And every once in a while you see one of those, it comes up, and then I think the sort of consciousness about that problem fades. So maybe we need sort of one of those to kind of get us all thinking about the same thing again. Or maybe if it just reaches this kind of like level of everybody knows somebody who's been affected, even if they've all been affected by different organisms, maybe if it reaches that level or starts to impact other treatments. One thing about infectious disease and the control of infectious disease, I think we don't always appreciate, is yes, infections can kill people, but they also they're like foundational to a lot of medicine. So the ability to treat somebody with chemotherapy is predicated on the ability to treat an infection that arises in somebody who's very immunocompromised. The ability to control other diseases, the ability to have surgeries safely, before antibiotics and antiseptic techniques, surgeries were very dangerous. So, once it gets to the point where maybe people are being affected because of the lack of access to surgery or to chemotherapy because of the difficulty with controlling infectious disease, that would also, I think, get people's attention. So there are a lot of, ways that this could happen. Hopefully it's not terrible before we get the attention we need, I think, on that problem.
Yeah. Something else I wanted to ask you about earlier, you were talking about kind of the difference between being able to treat a wound versus something more, I guess, systemic. When it comes to maybe something in the gut, how would that affect the ratio of bacteria in the gut? If it's only targeting some and not others, what effect might that have?
Yeah, so that's a place, actually, I think you picked up on a place where maybe you want to have incredible specificity. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if you've heard of the story of Clostridium difficile, C. difficile, C. diff.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that's an organism that's been really problematic. It basically is kind of an opportunistic pathogen that overgrows when you take certain antibiotics. So people get treated with an antibiotic for something, and then they develop the C. diff infection, a colitis, which is really terrible and until recently very difficult to treat. You know, people would get like colon resections to treat C. diff infections. But what ended up happening, so that's an example where like wiping out the microbial population in the gut was actually bad because it allowed this resistant organism to overgrow the kind of good germs. And more recently, there's been this microbiome therapy, fecal transplantation, which is kind of transplanting good germs back into the colon after antibiotics and after a C. diff infection to cure this infection, basically, by kind of readjusting the microbial population that's living there. So, yeah, that's like the gut could be a place where it might be difficult for an antibiotic to differentiate between the kind of good germs and the bad germs, whereas something that's very specific, like a phage, might actually be the preferred way to do it.
Right. And so a lot of times, you know, when you take antibiotics, they say, okay, make sure you take a probiotic with it. So in cases like this, where you would be using bacteriophages, do you think the antibiotic or the probiotic just isn't going to cut it in these circumstances?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess it would come down to like, you know, what exactly is in the probiotic and, you know, is that sufficient? And yeah, I don't know the answers to those questions. So it'll probably be like a case by case, but the gut is definitely a place where we want to keep an eye on that.
Yeah, especially just because isn't that the place in your body with the most bacteria in it? You know,
yes.
Outnumbering how many cells we have too.
Yes.
Crazy?
Yes, exactly. Yes, a ton of bacterial cells. You know, we keep learning more and more about the microbiome present on different parts of the body where we previously thought they were sterile. You know, I think people thought that bladders had no bacteria for a long time, but that turns out not to be true. Having said that, the amount of bacteria in the colon especially is just like huge compared to the amount. The digestive tract is a much richer environment for microbes than any other place in the body, I guess. So yeah, that could be the place where it's particularly important. Another place where I think we don't really have the knowledge yet to say whether or not it will be important, but in some places polymicrobial infections seem to be the problem, but we can't tell whether all of the organisms in there are pathogenic or if only like one or two of them are pathological and perhaps the rest are part of a normal microbiome. So something like a chronic wound, which is a big problem for the diabetic population, especially with poor circulation, high sugar levels in these wounds. They can have wounds that last for months or even years. And maybe a lot of the times there are multiple microbes in there. And maybe targeting the right microbes would be the way to treat those better. But I don't think we have the knowledge to say that if that's the case yet, but it's something to consider.
So say someone had a wound that was persistent, you're saying that there may be multiple types of bacteria present that normally wouldn't be on healthy skin, but only some of them might be disease causing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it might be that if you can perturb the system, so they're creating this pathological system, but it could be that if you take out one or two key players, then the rest of the microbial population could could actually be positive, you know, if they're part of the normal microbiome of a non-chronic wound. So yeah, it's, I think the only way to figure that out is to sort of try it, you know.
Would you take a sample of tissue?
How would you figure that out?
And kind of hit it with different bacteriophages and see what happens?
So I guess that there could be a few ways to approach this. So, you know, maybe the first place that people might start would be to try to recreate the system in vitro, just because of the expense of animal and human studies. So at the same time, clearly like an in vitro population that you create is probably going to be significantly different in many ways from an in vivo system. But probably people would start in vitro, try to validate their technique and the survival of the different components that they added, the different microbial components that they added. And then maybe once they validate that in vitro, then they could move on to some animal model to try to recreate a more realistic scenario. And then kind of depending on how that goes, you know, move forward from there. But yeah, I think that creating those model systems is actually, I think, a fascinating process that takes time in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to go back earlier, you said that part of what your lab also focuses on is, did you call them protocells?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So this is where the field where I did my graduate work also. There are a lot of reasons to think that life might have started with cells. So first of all, we know that all life is based on cells now. Mm-hmm. And you might say, well, why not just have like a pond full of chemicals that could somehow like transition to lifelike form? But I think there are some good reasons to think that these cellular compartments were important for very early stages of developing life. And one of them is just the fact that the membrane of the compartment keeps together certain molecules. So let's say you had a system where some proteins or RNA or DNA or whatever was building up. You want to kind of keep them together. So you can have that situation with the membrane, semi-permeable barrier. But then another piece of that, which I think is really important, is in terms of the evolution of the system. So if you think about kind of cooperative phenotypes at a molecular level, let's say you have an enzyme that is able to make copies of other sequences. So if you had something like that, you might ask, like, which direction is Darwinian evolution going to push that enzyme? You know, will it push it toward greater cooperativity? Will it push it toward being a better version of itself, of greater activity? Or will it push it toward parasitism, essentially, like, you know, becoming more simple and trying to take advantage of the enzymes that are around it to get copied? So if you have like a freely mixed environment, then it turns out that Darwinian evolution favors those molecules that are really good at being copied. And so you can have these kind of parasitic sequences evolving and sort of taking over, kind of overflowing the population and crowding out the more active sequences. There are a few different ways to there are probably, you know, many more than what we know of or have thought of, but there are definitely at least some ways to prevent that from happening, to kind of promote a more cooperative phenotype. And one of those is by compartmentalization. So keeping sequences together, if they're kind of forced to work in a group, then groups that work together better will outcompete groups that work worse together. So you'll still have these parasites arising, but because they drag down the group, then these the groups that actually don't have these parasites in them will persist and survive better. So having these cells is actually really important to favoring these cooperative systems and these more complex systems. That's been shown both in theory and in experimental systems. So these protocells are probably something that had to emerge relatively early, like as soon as you had some cooperative phenotypes starting to emerge, in order, if you wanted to be able to select and keep those from getting overtaken by parasitic sequences, then it would have been important to have these cells. So where we've been looking at the protocells is, okay, we know that the structure is important and we know that it survived until now. So we're interested in understanding kind of the biophysical impact of being inside a cell. Like, what does that do to the things that are encapsulated? Does it affect their evolution? Does it affect their folding, you know, the folding of an RNA or the folding of a protein? Is that affected by the fact that it's inside a vesicle or inside a compartment? So we've been looking at those types of questions too.
Cool. And have you found anything that you can talk about, or?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to discuss that too. So one of the things we've been finding is if you think about like a long chain, which is kind of how an RNA or protein is kind of in free solution, it can adopt many different conformations. And there's probably like one conformation which is well folded and it's active, it has the right configuration, all of its atoms are in the right place for some activity. But it can also adopt these kind of more extended conformations. If you think about taking that molecule, which can be in all these different states, and putting it inside a confined a cell, then suddenly it's in a position where it can't be too extended because it'll literally be like running into the walls and maybe have some interaction with the sides even before it kind of runs into the walls. So that confinement by itself creates kind of a pressure for the molecule to adopt a more compact form. And we found that encouragement of the compact form kind of favors folded structures, more highly active structures. And that actually translates into greater activity for, at least for RNA molecules. We've also seen it translate into faster evolution inside cells. So the fact that you have this additional kind of pressure on the RNAs also increases the differences between the kind of most active and the least active RNA sequences. And that makes that increase in the differences actually increases the pace of evolution. So we've found some kind of like interesting, I think non-intuitive kind of emergent properties, I guess you'd call them, just from putting an RNA inside of a cell.
Mm-hmm. And would that be like a bacterial cell? What kind of cell?
Oh, so we've been making artificial cells. These are fatty acid membranes mixed with phospholipids. So phospholipids are the kind of lipids that our cells are made out of. Fatty acids are kind of one of the components of phospholipids. Mm-hmm. If you've had olive oil, most of the, I think around 70% of olive oil is fatty acids. So, you know, that's the kind of, those relatively simple chemicals are what we're using for making these vesicles.
Wow. And does that mimic real cells that you would find in nature?
So the phospholipids, yes. And the reason why we're using these fatty acids is because fatty acids are something that can be made abiotically. Mm-hmm. So phospholipids, I don't think anyone has figured out at least how to make them outside of a biological system. But with fatty acids, there are several different ways that we could see them being made in a natural environment. So they're probably like available on the early Earth. There was a really nice study by David Deamer at UC Santa Cruz, where he took some of a meteorite, the Murchison meteorite, which is kind of famous for having lots of carbon and carbonaceous compounds in it. And this meteorite, he crushed up and extracted the kind of the lipid soluble fraction of that meteorite, and then dissolved it in water, and found that if you look at that extract under a microscope, you can see these self-assembled vesicle structures. So a lot of that is probably fatty acids, and there might be some other things in there too. But I guess it's just kind of pointing toward the ability for those kinds of structures to form and self-assemble on a early Earth.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's super fun.
You work on two really interesting research projects at the same time.
Yeah, that's been, it's kind of like a, there are some odd synergies that we get between these two parts of the lab. You know, they seem like very different projects, and they're kind of motivated by different thoughts and ideas. But a lot of the techniques and the things we think about are actually kind of similar. Mm-hmm. So it's been a lot of fun.
That's great. Claris, did you have any last questions?
Yeah, I had one. What do you want our audience to take away from this conversation today?
I hope that they'll get more interested in chemistry and the amazing applications it can have. I think when you're just learning it in like high school or even like the first year of college, maybe you don't see all the applications, which are really exciting. I think we've all kind of, after living through the pandemic, we've all seen how important biochemistry is and the kind of like bleeding edge. And how important it is for us to kind of push forward, even if we can't see the immediate applications right now. So, I hope people will keep that in mind when they're learning, you know, PV equals NRT. I hope they'll remember, like, those things have real-life applications. And we have so many interesting challenges coming up in the world, in health and medicine, but also climate change. So many problems that have solutions that technology can contribute to. I really hope people will start to see those connections and feel like, you know, if I learn these things, then I can make an impact.
If you enjoyed this podcast episode or simply want to know more about chemistry, visit us at chemistrytalk.org and follow us on all social media platforms, including Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok by searching ChemTalk. Thank you, and see you next time.